And Radio Derb is on the air. Greetings, listeners, from your familiarly genial host, John Derbyshire, bringing you VDare.com's weekly roundup of the news. There hasn't actually been a lot of news this week. None of the sort that grabs me by the whiskers, anyway. I shall therefore exercise podcaster's privilege and decorate the actual news stories with speculation, reminiscence, and some random word association stream of consciousness material. Heck, if they can get away with it at salon.com. I'll cover that item near the end of the podcast. Why can't I? On with the motley. President Trump fulfilled one of his campaign promises by withdrawing our country from last year's Paris Agreement on phasing out fossil fuel energy production. This is pure America First policymaking. The Paris Agreement was a big favourite with globalists, in spite of the fact that it wasn't actually very global. Sure, all the important nations signed on to it, but not on equal terms. The USA, in the person of Barack Obama, promised to reduce the USA's carbon dioxide emissions by at least 26% over 15 years. China only promised that their emissions would stop rising by 2030. Having, of course, risen mightily in the meantime. The fact that well-nigh every nation has signed on to the agreement tells you all by itself that nobody much takes it seriously. Only Syria and Nicaragua have not signed. Syria is busy with other issues, and nobody knows or cares where Nicaragua is or what happens to the place, if it even is a place. When 195 of the world's nations agree to something, without discord or rancour or the mobilisation of troops, you can be sure it's something of very little consequence to any of them. This is global-scale virtue signalling. And, as is the case with all virtue signalling, the Paris Agreement, so far as it has any content at all, is anti-white. It places the heaviest obligations on prosperous, successful, developed nations, which means mostly white nations. Apologies to the Japanese and Koreans, who, I would guess from some modest acquaintance with those nations, who signed the agreement in a spirit of pure, undiluted cynicism. And in case you're wondering, yes, North Korea is a signatory to the agreement too. A very telling index of the level of cynicism here. Setting aside the degree of sincerity with which the nations of the world have signed up to the Paris Agreement, the agreement itself amounts to nothing much. What, for example, would be the penalties against a nation that broke its promises under the Paris Agreement? And who would enforce those penalties? Answers: nothing and nobody. There is no enforcement mechanism. In the particular case of the USA, our signature to the agreement anyway has no force, as it's not a treaty, as defined in our Constitution. Article 2, Section 2 of that blessed document specifies that the President, quote, shall have power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided 2/3 of the senators present concur. End quote. Obama never went through that little formality, so the agreements have no legal force in our country. So, pretty much anything to do with the Paris Agreement is just gestural. Our signing up to it was a gesture. Our leaving it is a gesture. Neither act makes any difference to your life or mine. President Trump's pulling out of the agreement was, at least, though, a gesture in the right direction. As I said, it was a gesture to his America First principle. As he said, quote, "I was elected to represent the citizens of Pittsburgh, not Paris." End quote. The mayor of Pittsburgh grumbled that his citizens actually voted 80% for Mrs. Clinton, but that's splitting hairs. President Trump was elected, and the American electorate, in its collective wisdom, elects a president to represent them all, including those who didn't vote for the winning candidate. Given what a nothing burger this all is, the reactions both at home and abroad to Trump's announcement have been bizarrely disproportionate. Ex-President Obama said Trump had, quote, "joined a small handful of nations that reject the future." German Chancellorette Angela Merkel paused briefly from handing over her country to Muslim invaders to tell us that Trump, quote, "can't and won't stop all those of us who feel obliged to protect the planet," end quote. A tabloid newspaper in her nation ran a front page heading saying, "Earth to Trump, you." That headline was, of course, in German, except for the bleep, which was Anglo-Saxon. Or in this case, I guess, just Saxon. The Chinese Communist Party, as represented by their propaganda outlet Global Times, honked that, honk, "the selfishness and irresponsibility of the USA will be made clear to the world, crippling the country's world leadership," end honk. That is from a gang that has yet to apologise to its own citizens for having murdered 30 million of them. Selfishness and irresponsibility, right. Liberals, globalists and white ethno-masochists, what Chinese bloggers derisively call the Bides War, the white left, were hyperventilating fit to burst. Showbiz airheads were, of course, to the fore. Victoria's Secret bimbo Candice Swanepoel lamented that, quote, "we are nothing without a healthy planet. Nothing." End quote. What, you never heard of Miss Swanepoel? Me neither until this morning. She looks really nice in a spangled bikini. All the weeping and wailing demonstrates yet again, if it needed demonstrating yet again, that as religion has ebbed from the public life in advanced countries, politics has taken its place. The kind of passions that once fired up Arians and Athanasians, Protestants and Catholics, pre-millennials and post-millennials against each other, have been transferred to the political realm. Those modules of the human mind that used to fix on the nature of the gods and the best way to appease them are now busy with matters of public policy, bringing to political issues the same excess of heat and deficit of light that religious passions once generated. In this new schema, global warming is a sort of apocalypse or judgment day. Repent, you sinners! The sinners in this case being civilized white folk. Repent! Where global warming is concerned, Radio Derb continues its refusal to be concerned. If there's a problem, it's a gradual one, and we'll science our way out of it somehow, I'm sure. That's we, the civilized nations. Things might get dire for backward regions a few decades on, but things are likely going to get dire for them anyway, with resource depletion and uncontrolled population growth. We need to take care of ourselves, and, if necessary, practice lifeboat ethics. The thing that mainly irks me about the global warming fuss is, in fact, that it directs our political energies towards things we shouldn't bother about and away from pressing matters that we should bother about, and some of which we can actually change with some straightforward legislation. I'm thinking mostly, of course, about mass immigration and the demographic transformation of Western countries. But there are other issues too that warrant much more political attention than global warming. There's the fiscal problem of nations whose populations are ageing. There is getting to a rational, cost-effective healthcare system. There's rusting infrastructure. There is a swelling pool of citizens made unemployable by advances in automation and artificial intelligence. In the list of things I want my politicians to work on, to come up with solutions for, global warming ranks around about number 49. And then, in among that leading 48, there is nuclear war. The Derbyshire household owns a domestic water cooler. It arrived 15 or so years ago when we signed a contract with Poland Spring to deliver drinking water to us. They used to deliver it in 5-gallon plastic drums that you upended and set on top of the water cooler. Then my wife decided that Poland Spring was too expensive and she terminated the contract. She makes all these petty, trivial decisions in the household, while I decide more important things, like what our position on global warming should be. Anyway, terminating the contract left us with this water cooler that we weren't getting any more 5-gallon refills for. It sat there forlornly in the dining room for, 7 or 8 years, until we had some contractors in to give us new floors. They moved the water cooler to the garage, and we forgot all about it. Forward 3 more years to last month. I'm clearing out the garage, getting rid of unwanted items. Contemplating the water cooler, I suddenly remembered seeing 5-gallon drums of water for sale at Home Depot, way cheaper than the Poland Spring product. I mentioned this to the missus. We could have purified water again without that pesky overpriced Poland Spring contract. She agreed. I cleaned up the cooler, replaced it in the dining room, and loaded a 5-gallon drum on top. Down in the basement next day, I heard a drip, drip, dripping. That water cooler was leaking right through our newish floor. I opened it up to investigate, but it wasn't anything I knew how to fix. Our water cooler is now headed to the municipal dump. Talking to the missus about this, I mentioned one of my dad's pearls of daddish wisdom. Machines, he used to say, like to be used. If you don't use them, they sink into despair and lose the will to live, or at any rate to perform their assigned functions. Park your car in the garage for 6 months, it won't start. I've gone through life believing this. Thanks, Dad. And the water cooler episode confirmed it. What's that got to do with nuclear war? Well, nuclear war uses nuclear weapons. The USA stopped making nukes after the Cold War ended a quarter century ago. The last time we tested a nuke to make sure that, you know, it would, like, work, was, in fact, just 25 years ago this coming September. So, is our nuclear stockpile to the USA what that Poland spring water cooler was to the Derbyshire household? If you ask a government person, he will laugh merrily and say, of course not. Then he'll direct you to the National Nuclear Security Administration, the NNSA. That's an agency within the Department of Energy, which runs a stockpile stewardship and management program to keep our 30 and 40 year old nukes clean and shiny and in good working order, ready to go. Great. Given that it's a government program, though, run by one of the least glamorous government departments, and that the engineers and technicians who actually know how to make nukes all retired 20 years ago, and that we've just had 8 years of a nuke-hostile administration, and, bearing in mind John Robert Derbyshire's universal law of machines, as just cited, I can't help but wonder. All of this was inspired by a news story this week that on Tuesday we successfully tested an anti-missile missile. I suppose in response to North Korean blustering. Hitting a bullet with a bullet is the Pentagon's advertising slogan for this technology. The track record for these tests is not actually very good. So much so, there are reasons to think that the stuff about hitting a bullet with a bullet is deliberate misinformation. The best way to deal with an incoming ballistic missile is to intercept it with a powerful nuclear warhead while it's high above the Earth's atmosphere. Not hitting a bullet with a bullet, but vaporizing a bullet with a nearby nuclear blast. It's likely that is what we really want to do in a real war scenario. Which brings us back to the question, are our nukes fit for purpose? I have no idea, but I sure hope so. Steve Saylor's been running a discussion on this over at his blog, with the usual high quality of well-informed and informative comments. By all means, pursue the matter there. I just want to make the point once again that this issue, and at least 47 others like it, are way more important to the USA than some bogus agreement on global warming. And, as a footnote to all that, please allow me to recycle an apothegm from my old National Review colleague, Jeff Hart. Quote, I don't think we should make any more nukes until we've used the ones we've got. End quote. So, no, I don't lose sleep over global warming, which is happening slowly enough for us to deal with it. When I do lose sleep, which, to be perfectly honest, is not very often, it's about real, sudden civilizational catastrophes. Things that are very possible, that in some cases have actually happened in the remote past. Things that could leave a dazed few million survivors, perhaps just a few thousand, transported overnight from our present sophisticated, bustling environment back to a Paleolithic state, our cities and factories all in ruins. Or, if they're still intact, with no one left that knows how to work anything. I'm thinking of asteroid strikes mass volcanism, the parent star misbehaving, nuclear war, massive plagues, and so on. It's morbid, I know, but I'm a Cold War baby. Duck and cover! And there are still asteroids. There are still volcanoes. The sun can still misbehave. New diseases still come up. And the nukes are still there, in some condition. What all this got me thinking about was John Gribbin's book, Alone in the Universe, which I read a few weeks ago. The book, which I recommend if you're interested in this sort of thing, argues the case that for life to arise on a planet, to develop to an intelligent species like ours, and thence to a technological civilization like ours, all depends on a highly improbable chain of circumstances, and so happens very, very, very rarely. I'm not going to engage with that argument here. I'm only going to point out one of Gribbin's secondary points. Once a technological civilization has gotten started, he says, all kinds of unpleasant things can bring it down. Things like the calamities I just mentioned. If one of those dreadful things happened, he argues, to a civilization at our level, or a bit higher, the survivors would not be able to rebuild back to our level. Why not? Because we have extracted and used up all the natural resources, like metal ores and fossil fuels, that were easy to get to. We're still extracting all that good stuff, of course, but nowadays we need lots of technology and metals and fossil fuels to do the job. My great-grandparents in mid-19th century England, according to family lore, owned a butty mine. That's a deposit of coal close enough to the surface that a man with a shovel could dig it out and sell it to his neighbours. There are no more butty mines in England. I doubt there are any elsewhere. To get coal now, or iron, or copper, or oil, you need lots of technology. And coal, and iron, and copper, and oil. So, the survivors of a major catastrophe wouldn't be able to get technological civilization going again. We might get back up to the level of ancient Egypt, but then we'd be stuck at that level. Forever. If this argument is right, and it sounds right to me, the human race is performing trapeze without a net. I'm afraid I may have misled you, gentle listener. Back in mid-May, I passed some remarks about the upcoming British election. Voting is next Thursday, June the 8th. I told you that the election was a foregone conclusion, that the Tory party, who currently control the House of Commons, and the government under Prime Minister Theresa May, will win easily, while the other big party, Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, will lose bigly. Well, I spoke too soon. It turns out that Mrs. May is not only an ineffectual cuck, but she's also politically inept. She proposed, for example, changes to public provision for helpless old people. If a person had to go into full-time nursing home care provided by the state, then when they died, their house could be sold to pay off the costs of care. There was to be a base sum, £100,000, that's $130,000, that would be left untouched for the family to inherit. The state would get everything else. That was of no great concern to poor people who don't own houses, or to rich people who can afford their own nursing home care. But it was a big blow against the home-owning middle classes. A core Tory constituency! The other parties jumped all over it as a, quote, dementia tax. That was hyperbolic, but it played well with the voters, and Mrs. May had to back down. Then she failed to show up for one of the candidate debates. She sent her Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, to stand in for her. Ms. Rudd stepped up gamely, in spite of her father having passed away the day before. She didn't do very well in the debate, though, and the whole affair allowed the media to put forward their favourite theme of the Tories as the heartless, nasty party, and Labour as the loving, kind party. The British media are going all out to promote the more left-wing of the two big parties, which is the Labour Party. The media over here do the same thing, of course. At the slightest hint by a Republican candidate that social benefits might be tweaked, TV newscasters and talking heads are telling us that granny will be pushed out into the snow to die of exposure, little kiddies will go to bed hungry, you'll be turned away at the hospital emergency room, and so on. You know the narrative well enough, I'm sure. In fact, in Britain, just as here, the voting public loves its welfare state. And serious politicians all know this. All but the most inept of them take care to stay out of the welfare state minefield. Note how Donald Trump on the campaign trail promised to preserve Social Security and Medicare. Nobody thinks those programs can stay unchanged forever, but nobody who wants to get elected to anything would be such a fool as to say so out loud. In fact, Social Security and Medicare do get tweaked now and again, stealthily, when the government believes no one much is looking, and slightly so as not to wake the dragon. Sure, these programmes might fall off a cliff in 2030-something, but no politician thinks that far ahead, except for purposes of virtue signalling. Messing with the welfare state is not virtuous, except in a few libertarian think tanks that no politician pays attention to. So, Mrs. May is falling over her feet, and the media is throwing everything they've got at her. The beneficiary here is old lefty Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party leader. The latest poll from YouGov, that's one of the more reliable polls, shows 38% intending to vote for Corbyn, the Labour guy. Incredible! For a candidate far to the left of Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders? Heck, Corbyn is to the left of Walter Ulbricht. He's still a long shot to be the next Prime Minister, but on the YouGov numbers, Mrs. May might very well lose her majority in Parliament, meaning she'd have to go into coalition with some other party, even cuckier than she is. Or possibly not. I've been reading a very interesting research paper out of the London School of Economics. The researchers looked at the motivation of voters in last year's Brexit referendum. To quote them, "Immigration was key." End quote. They then further discovered that within that factor, it was non-European immigration that motivated people to vote out of the European Union. Public discussion of immigration is even more constrained and fearful over there than it is here, with everyone terrified to be thought racist. Such open discussion as there was about immigration in the Brexit campaign focused on low-skilled workers from Eastern Europe. Well, it turns out British people don't mind that. It's non-Europeans, blacks and Muslims, that bother them. It took academic research to uncover that. It was lurking away hidden because voters were scared to talk about it. I'm sure that's one reason the Brexit vote came as a surprise. The Brits may deliver a similar surprise on Thursday. Mrs. May is pretty useless on immigration, but Labour are worse than useless. A key figure here is Diane Abbott, Corbyn's shadow Home Secretary. That is, she'll be in charge of immigration in a Corbyn government. Abbott is a big, rude, high-tea black woman, a sort of British Maxine Waters, although with a triple-digit IQ. And she's known to favour open borders. Corbyn himself is less frank than that, but the two are, as the Chinese say, as close as lips and teeth. In fact, Corbyn had an affair with Ms. Abbott 40 years ago, so presumably they were even closer than lips and teeth for a while there. If the Tories lean hard on the immigration issue, they may yet save their parliamentary majority. Mrs. May's track record suggests she has neither the courage nor the good political sense to do that. But the Brits may confound the polls by voting on their immigration preferences anyway, as they did in the Brexit referendum last year. We shall find out this coming week. I caused some confusion among listeners by saying in last week's podcast the following thing in regard to mass third world immigration. Quote, "We, America, can still turn the tide. I wouldn't say that about England, nor about Britain as a whole, unless the Welsh and the Scots assert themselves forcefully as nations, which I see no sign of. I think England's too far gone." End quote. That, complained listeners, left their heads spinning. England? Britain? What? Isn't it all the UK nowadays? Okay, the basics. There's a bunch of islands off the northwest coast of Europe. Their name is the British Isles. There's one great big island, one other that's 40% as big, and hundreds of teeny ones. The Romans called the big island Britannia, and the less big one Hibernia. The big one is nowadays called Britain, and the other one Ireland. You with me so far? For historical reasons that are way too complex to go into, Britain developed into three ethnostates called England, Wales and Scotland. These three ethnostates are joined with the northeastern one-sixth of Ireland in a sovereign nation called the UK. The other five-sixths of Ireland are a different sovereign nation, the Irish Republic. So, two major islands, five ethnostates, two sovereign nations. Got it? The history is really complex, and some of it is still hotly emotional. As just one random marker of the complexity, note that Scotland is, of course, the land of the Scots. But Scot was the medieval word for an Irishman. Go look it up. One more. If you read early medieval history, there was an on-and-off war through the later 5th and early 6th century between the British and the English. That was the war in which the British hero was King Arthur, except that he may not have existed, who fought and won a mighty battle against the English at Badon Hill, except that nobody knows where that is. A study of British history, I mean, damn it, the history of the British Isles, gives you a very good feel for what an unholy mess history is. If just a couple of foggy islands generated all this complexity, who knows what the hell is up with Indonesia or Africa? Well, our policymakers and diplomats know, of course. They know everything. They even know how to fix the Middle East. Lots of luck there, guys. And yes, there's a related news story here. Over there in the UK, there's a TV talent show called Britain's Got Talent, a sort of limey version of American Idol. Probably the show should be called The UK's Got Talent, but it isn't, and I can't do anything about it. One of the entries in this week's semi-final of the show was a women's choir from Wales, the Angelicus Celtis Choir. They sang that fine old hymn, Jerusalem, which is a sort of unofficial English national anthem. The words to Jerusalem are those of a poem by the deeply weird romantic poet William Blake, floro it around 1800. The first two lines go, "And did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green?" End quote. The feet in question belong to Jesus of Nazareth. There are a couple of other references to England in the song. Blake was speculating that Jesus may have paid a visit to England, at that time the Roman province of Britannia. Yes, it's wildly improbable, but as I said, Blake was one weird dude, and his Christianity was the weirdest of his weirdnesses. Those dark satanic mills in the 8th line of the poem, for example, are, according to some respectable literary scholars, the altars of the Church of England. Well, this choir of Welsh females changed all those references to England. They sang Britain instead. A rough equivalent would be Kate Smith singing God Bless the North American Landmass. Outrage ensued. You can gauge the heat of the outrage by noting that the YouTube clip of the event comes with the legend, "Comments are disabled for this video." When comments are disabled on a video or a news story, you know that the incoming comments were really, really angry. YouTube and other major outlets don't like us when we're angry. There was, of course, a Twitter storm. What would 21st century outrage be without a Twitter storm? The sense of the meeting was that Welsh people had no business singing an English song, and that if they couldn't be stopped from singing it, they should at least sing the original English words. A pacifist minority attempted to lower the emotional temperature by suggesting that it would have been okay for the Welsh gals to sing about Britain if they had sung in the Welsh language, which is very much alive. That ironic minority was, however, soon chased out of town. Their houses were bulldozed and bonfires were made of their movable property. Warriors on both sides are suiting up to refight the Battle of Badon Hill. Arthur, the British hero, may have won the original battle, but the British were losers at last. The English took most of their territory after Arthur died, supposing he ever lived. The greater part of Britain became England, and the British were left to skulk in those foggy western hills, turning themselves into what we nowadays call the Welsh, from an old English word for foreigner. Yes, it's a Twitter storm in a teacup. There are large general lessons to be drawn, though, as I've already indicated. A big topic in today's public debates is nationalism versus globalism. Progressives promise us that if we just drop those dusty, nasty, superficial, out-of-date attachments to tribe, ethnicity and race, everything in the world will be tickety-boo. Black and white, Arab and Jew, settler and aborigine, we'll all dance round the maypole together in happy harmony. Stories like this one suggest that there may be some aspects of our human nature that the progressives are not taking into account. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. It was 50 years ago today. Well, actually this week. Yes, the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper album came out June 1st, 1967. I remember it well. I was, in fact, living in Liverpool at the time. Nice to recall that. But what would any news story about the culture be in 2017 without some victim American showing up to whine about it? So here she is. Feminist Amanda Marcotte, a writer for Cult Marx website, salon.com. What is Ms. Marcotte's problem with Sgt. Pepper? The gravamen of her charge is that prior to the Sgt. Pepper album, the Beatles' music was aimed at teenage girls, but that from Sgt. Pepper on, they turned their songs all masculine and nerdy. Ms. Marcotte got 1,200 words out of that, which I'm bound to say, as a writer myself, I find pretty darn impressive. I'd rank Ms. Marcotte up there with the late British opinion journalist Alan Bryan, who boasted that he could get 1,000 words of copy out of the fluff in his navel. That was before victimological whining became an established genre within opinion journalism, though. Here's Ms. Marcotte's closing sentence. Get your hankies out. Quote, part of me will always begrudge the record its reputation, because it helped lead to a world where certain kinds of pop music were treated as inferior for decades, just because its fan base was mostly people who looked like me. Item. Barack Obama and his wife have bought their house in Washington, D.C. They had been renting it. Now they've bought it. 9 bedrooms, 8.5 bathrooms, $8.1 million. Don't the Obamas already own a house in Chicago? Yes, they do. 7 bathrooms, unknown number of bedrooms. Very Tony neighbourhood. Last listed on Zillow as worth $3 million. But hey, you can never have too many houses. These are the rewards of what our masters are pleased to call public service. Within my own lifetime, politicians used to leave office broke, or at best poorer than when they came in. I hate this. We should at least stop paying the buggers a pension. Repeal the former President's Act. Item. Here's another one of those news stories that's interesting mainly for the comment thread. May 19th, a big game hunter in Zimbabwe, a 51-year-old white South African named Thunis Botha, was killed by an elephant. Mr. Botha and some other hunters had come across the herd of elephants and they opened fire. The elephants charged and one of them picked up Mr. Botha with its trunk. Another hunter shot the elephant, hoping it would let Mr. Botha go. The elephant fell on top of Mr. Botha, crushing him to death. My main reaction to the story was, well, at least he died doing what he liked to do, hunting big, dangerous game animals for sport. How many people get a death certificate that reads, crushed by a falling elephant? The Mail Online comment thread, however, leaned heavily pro-elephant, anti-Botha. Sample. Poetic justice, R.I.P. poor elephant. Sample. So glad he is dead. It's the elephant I'm mourning, along with all the other innocents he has murdered. Sample. Good. I hope he died slowly with the elephant's breath the last thing he heard. And so on. I'll just make again the point I made during the fuss over Cecil the Lion 2 years ago. These charismatic megafauna are only allowed to live because of the revenues that nations like Zimbabwe get by licensing the hunting of them. Without that, they would swiftly be poached to extinction, especially elephants, whose ivory makes them exceptionally worth poaching. I no more favour cruelty to animals than those commenters do. The actual choice here, though, is between the killing of a few by licensed hunters and the killing of all by poachers. If these commenters really care, above the level of posting callous, snarky comments on a news website, if they really care, let them head out to Zimbabwe and take on the poachers. Now that I'd like to see. That's the news for this week, ladies and gents. Thank you for listening. And to my compatriots here in the USA, welcome to summer. Easy pick for sign-out music this week. Here's Yuri Bielohlavik conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra and Choir at the last night of the Proms 2012. This is the real Jerusalem. If you watch the YouTube clip, you'll get a feel for how emotional it is. People are actually crying. The flags on display are mostly the UK's, but there are a lot of England flags, the Cross of St. George, also in evidence. I spotted an Irish flag in there somewhere, but no Welsh flags at all. Ha! There will be more from Radio Derb next week.